Chapter 4. Free Speech on Trial. This is not like what the Mafia does. This is what the Mafia does. Matt Taibbi on Bill Moyers. Remember the subprime mortgage crisis? The banks made bad loans and then bundled and sold them off, cashing in on your misfortune, foreclosing on your homes. They were the ones who were supposed to protect your money, but it wasn't in their best interests financially. Remember when newspapers went digital? The papers started writing bad stories and then sold them to you, cashing in on your mistakes, scaring and humiliating you. They were the ones who were supposed to protect the truth, but it wasn't in their best interests financially. Before you cry, victimless crime, look a little closer at the human cost of this new economy. Homeowners displaced, reputations ruined, and for what? Bitcoins? Page views? What about the ever-emerging industries that will help you clean up the mess for a price? It's a brave new economy, and the biggest victim in this market is the truth. The emperor struts about naked, and nobody says nothing. Spin this down to the matter at hand, and we see how the 24-hour news cycle generates financial opportunity for all involved, a chance to spend, and a chance to earn. What a field day for the media. While Michelle quietly planted seeds of truth at low-wattage public radio stations, sound bites like homophobic rant and mass walkout went viral. Check out the dates and times for these news vendors that rushed in to break the story. Both were published on March 18, 2013, less than 24 hours after the event at Yoshi's. Emily Savage's San Francisco Bay Guardian article appeared at 12:35 p.m., and Chris Willman's Yahoo Entertainment News article showed up at 3:53 p.m., a race that left little time for investigative reporting, but generated headlines that ensured at least one encore. Flashbulbs popped, newsboys howled, and everybody clicked. The result was a deluge of hate mail in Michelle's inbox, mixed with polite requests from more reporters to help her set the record straight. It was, in a word, extortion. Reporters wanted exclusive content to please their sponsors, but invariably, the more content they generated, the less anyone really understood. Did you know that the more traffic a website gets, the less time readers spend actually engaged in the content? It's true. Paul Grabowitz, a senior lecturer and associate dean and director of the new media program at UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, noticed the correlation in their study between the number of monthly page views on three news sites and the average time spent on each story. The Richmond Confidential had the highest amount of engagement with 20,000 page views, but Mission Local, with 203,000 page views, only succeeded in capturing an average of less than 2 minutes of the reader's attention. Check the number of page views and shares on the stories you read, then look at the intelligence of the comments and decide if the commenters actually read the story or if they move straight from headline to howling commentary. Combine the rush to comment with the rush to break a story, and you have a prime example of how fresh content is just raw meat for this media monster. Twitter seems to be the center of this cycle, but the stories that fuel the engine come from blogs and news vendors nearby. In this case, the story started fairly high on the food chain. It appeared at the top of my Yahoo News feed, and the words homophobic rant so puzzled me that I went ahead and clicked, despite my suspicion that it was probably just tabloid journalism. I found the two early articles to be rife with speculation. Neither writer had actually spoken with Michelle. Without many other options, I started digging through the digital rubble with whatever tools I had, but a thick layer of debris had already piled up. Every story said the same thing. Each headline became more and more simplified. My Facebook friends were no help, quickly deciding that Michelle was simply having a psychotic break due to too much religion and too little medication. There was nothing to do but scrape off the top layer and seek out articles that had been written prior to Yoshi's. In these earlier articles, I learned that Michelle had spoken openly of her sexuality, her political convictions, her Christianity, her relationships with family and lovers, and of abuse she had endured. Later, when we spoke on the phone, she shared just as generously. Her story, while having private moments, has never been off the record. The hashtag, "privacy is for pussies," emerged as a Twitter joke, but it speaks volumes regarding her life in a fishbowl. She shares her grief and joy without reserve. Even so, finding unbiased sources was very difficult. Willman's Yahoo News story on the 18th was followed by another one on the 19th. The title? Michelle Shocked, Hate Monger, or Misunderstood Provocateur. Don't feel bad if you only read the first three words. You're not alone. I took one look at the word hate monger and skipped right over it. Willman has been on the Twitter train from the start, presenting career counseling in a tone so pedantic that Michelle once said she'd rather lick cat fur than take his advice. After the initial sympathetic story, he followed up in April 2013 with two others, one quoting Howard Stern as an authority on her sanity in Michelle Shocked, Amid a Meltdown, Jesus is Her Crisis PR Consultant, and the other focusing on her inability to completely clarify her motives in a short interview with Piers Morgan on CNN. Willman said later that when he watched the interview, he wanted to shake her and tell her, "You have 2 minutes to make your point before people's minds start to wander." Michelle was no more interested in his advice than she was in simplifying the situation for easy listening. Michelle coined the term bloggerazzi for writers like this. They find or create news stories that they can then supplement or recast later as blog posts, interviews, podcasts, etc. They're in no hurry, though. Once the story is planted, these seemingly ephemeral words become part of your permanent record. And you better not question it. It's like when my dad's friend asked to see his FBI file back in the 70s. They let him see it, but the next time he asked, there was a report in it that said he had, wait for it, asked to see his file. Sure, you can try to defend yourself, but it's a risk. On April 1st, Michelle agreed to appear on CNN to talk with Piers Morgan, but the format didn't exactly lend itself to a heart-to-heart. Michelle appeared stressed. Morgan cut her off and came across as a bully when she started to talk about how she had literally set the stage at Yoshi's. One frustrated commenter said, "Rest in peace, journalism," while another said, "Where is the rest of the interview? I was looking forward to hearing what she had to say, but apparently this wasn't the place to look for that." Subtlety and nuance are casualties of this kind of iterative journalism. Regardless of the content of the articles, only the headlines are repeated and retweeted. Today's journalism is a la carte, and any attempt to argue merely spreads the meme further. How orchestrated are these mobs? Bill Maher offered this opinion. "I think there is a gay mafia. I think if you cross them, you do get whacked. I really do." What better target than an alleged homophobe who won't play the game? As for me, I stayed on Twitter and listened. Willman was there too, posting and removing comments on a daily basis, posting, he claimed, to help Michelle understand the hard questions she would need to answer, and deleting so his 15,000 followers wouldn't have to dig through his feed for more important information about the hairstyles and faux pas of the rich and famous. When I questioned his ethics in a private message, he claimed, "I try to be neither predatory nor parasitical." I wasn't convinced. He followed her every move, and his followers followed him. When it was suggested that she might sue him, he sent the message, "If only you would." He emailed her in December 2013, saying he was wistful for the times he had anticipated a breakthrough in communication, like when she invited him to her trial. Her invitation was more of a dare, but he didn't take it as such. In July, this professional journalist had showed up at her long-awaited bench trial. She was charged with a misdemeanor, reduced to an infraction, resulting from her arrest on November 30, 2011, during the eviction from City Hall of the Occupy LA encampment. Of the 300-plus arrested that night, she was among a handful who refused to take the terms of a plea bargain, which simply required that she watch a video about the First Amendment. Instead, with the support of First Amendment champions Joseph Lowe and Sonia Chaisson, she fought for the words she repeats often. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. After 8 continuances, the prosecutor moved that the charges be dropped. Free speech won the day, but Michelle was still being censored in real life, and the biggest mobber on the block was claiming immunity as a journalist. Here's a tweet from Chris Willman to Michelle, advising, "Everybody needs a hobby, but writing songs might be a better one." Michelle replies, "Tell it to your social media audience. I'm just fodder for your kangaroo court of public opinion. Leave me alone." And again in a separate tweet, "Leave me alone. You've said it was the last time dozens of times. Now leave me alone. Now." Why, after Michelle had clearly told him to leave her alone, was he still jumping on every mention of her name? Amy Gadja, law professor at Tulane University, explains that in a day when everyone can be a publisher, we need to define journalist in a very narrow way. It's a protected, privileged status. So the question of what is newsworthy has to be limited. She says journalists should have to struggle with these decisions, and that we don't all get to not testify. When confronted with the suggestion that his constant interference in the story was unprofessional, Chris Willman finally agreed to become transparent, kind of. He deleted a number of tweets and then deactivated the anonymous troll account at Georgia's Brother, but he kept at Jiminy Croquet. It's still there if you take a notion to look. But until you prove yourself worthy as an anti-shocked troll, you won't be admitted past the gate. Chris Willman tweets, "At Georgia's Brother is toast, as vowed earlier today. Given the penchant for conspiracy theories, I'd rather be above board on all communiques." Quadfin Writer tweets, at Chris Willman, "Nothing proclaims a new policy of openness and candor like deleting all 1,000 tweets there first." Chris Willman wasn't the only journalist behaving badly. Just 3 days after the San Francisco Bay Guardian published the bootleg and the story about Michelle's alleged meltdown at Yoshi's, Samuel Liss of the San Francisco Examiner contacted her. He heard she had apologized and wondered if she wanted to buy a couple of full-page ads, one in the Examiner and another in the San Francisco Bay Guardian. Price combo package? $2,500. Ballsy, huh? The same paper that broke the story was now offering Michelle a chance to pay to play. Extortion? Or just business as usual? Whatever it was, Michelle declined, saying, "I'm just not seeing any light at the end of this tunnel." The script is already written in these situations. You cross big gay and you get whacked. Publicly, of course. Then you take the apology route and pay a few people off. And in a few weeks or months, your reputation is good as new, maybe even better because you aligned with the proper authorities. Here's the question. Do professional gay pride organizations actually represent the political and financial interests of the 3% of the population that happen to be queer? Or has the spectrum gotten a bit muddy? Back in the 90s, I helped a small committee rejuvenate Kansas City's gay pride events. We had a bring-your-own-food picnic in a public park and invited Mayor Emanuel Cleaver to speak. There was a bit of entertainment, some gals with guitars, a men's choir, and a few booths that informed us all about the AIDS epidemic. It was small and neighborly, and I still remember a few random park-goers who observed our fun and bravely joined in with our celebration. Within 3 years, our little Pride Fest was taken up by a more professional group, and it turned into a pay-to-enter party that resembled every other gay pride celebration in the nation. It was, for lack of a better word, successful. I don't know who the first sponsors were, but I do know that they had to have been left-leaning groups that were bold enough to take a stand in a fairly hostile environment. Today, it's not like that. LGBT organizations can pick and choose among many suitors, the likes of whom might surprise even the log cabin Republicans. It's not just Bud Light anymore. It's AT&T, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Clear Channel, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin. Yes, every sleazy mortgage lender, right-wing media monster, and military contractor was now romancing my little 3%. Do we really spend that much money? Who are these people anyway? And why is it so important to them to represent me? Enter Bradley, now Chelsea Manning. You remember the story, right? The Army private who blew the whistle on illegal military activities by leaking 700,000 classified U.S. government documents? Manning was subject to 11 months of 23-hour-a-day solitary confinement in a military base allegedly in order to protect him, but more likely to encourage him to break down and implicate others. Note, this did not happen under the Bush regime. It happened under the current liberal administration. To some, he was a hero. To the sponsors of SF Pride, not so much. But in a bold move, an electoral college made up of the former SF Pride Grand Marshals chose Manning to be their next Grand Marshal. Knowing that he could not attend, they named another whistleblower, Daniel Ellsberg, to be his stand-in. Now, remember that rainbow? The one that has a full spectrum of opinions and ideas? It turned gray within a day. Almost immediately, Lisa Williams, board president of SF Pride, said that there had been a mistake and that the offending party had been disciplined. Dissenting arguments would not be heard. In fact, even a hint of support would not be tolerated. Are we proud now? Or did we just sell out? I'll let you mull that one over for a bit. So, did Michelle jump the shark when she conflated Todd Vogt's offer with the activities behind the scenes of SF Pride? Well, considering the fact that the new publisher of The Examiner, Todd Vogt, had just bought all the alternative weeklies in town, including the queer ones, probably not. Meanwhile, back at the Twitter ranch, similar power games were unfolding. As June approached, Michelle once again heard from the paper of record. Samuel wrote again saying that the SF Examiner was putting together the Pride Guide, which would be the perfect place for you to place an ad. Michelle played along, but stopped just short of actually sending cash. Now, editor Todd Vogt himself chimed in with a modest proposal. If Michelle bought a full-page ad in the Pride Guide, Todd would arrange for her to do a free show in June, write a 1,000-word op-ed in the Examiner, and give an exclusive interview for SF Weekly with writer Ian S. Port. In exchange, he would spring for airfare and lodging. Oh, and he would pimp the hell out of the concert in all three papers. He also assumed that enough time had passed that she surely wanted a really big microphone with which to apologize. Check out this Freudian slip. Here's a clip from an email from Todd Vogt to Michelle. I will arrange a cover feature sorry in SF Weekly. Ian Port, music editor, will write it. Surely Michelle must want so much to set the record straight that she would pimp her own talents to buy the microphone back. And clearly, he had not been following the plot. At no point had Michelle pulled out the big PR guns. At no point had she taken the traditional apology route. The feature sorry wasn't going to happen, but the cat-and-mouse game continued for a few weeks. First off, Vogt dangled three possible venues: the Castro Theater, Slim's, and ironically, a possible encore at Yoshi's. Michelle chose June 30th for the date, as it coincided with Gay Pride Week. Nothing was set in stone as the interview approached. Nerves were high, and Michelle knew very well that it was her head on the platter, not his. He and his paper would benefit regardless of the outcome. Her suspicions were further aroused after seeing her friend Roger's research about Vogt's previous near miss with justice regarding indictments about shady business deals handed down to Vogt's former associates at Canadian media group Hollinger International. The whole thing reeked of media manipulation. As the interview approached, many emails were sent. There was a lengthy discussion with Ian S. Port about whether or not he would be allowed to record his interview. It was similar to the negotiation that had happened with Nicole Sandler. Michelle wasn't interested in giving these reporters free audio content that they could trade with later. With no assurance that he could record, Port arrived in beautiful downtown Burbank, assuming that Michelle wanted to tell her story so badly that she would let him record, even though she had said no. How wrong he was. Upon arrival, he was met by Michelle's friend, Roger Trilling, who took him to lunch and explained that she would only participate if he took notes by hand. He rejected the offer and headed back to San Francisco. On June 16th, Port published a slightly defensive but surprisingly unbiased report titled, The Michelle Shocked Thing, How the SF Weekly Got Swept Up into a Media Maelstrom. He ended with these words. Watching these controversies unfold, we tend to think we're standing outside of the storm, able to see and define and comment on it. But as journalists, publishers, musicians, and social media users, we are the turbulence. We are the story we're trying to tell. And sometimes, those stories just don't end with one tweetable truth. We were indeed the story. So maybe forcing Port's hand paid off. He was the first to really focus on the role that media played in creating and perpetuating the story. Meanwhile, Michelle invited Vogt to Twitter to announce the package deal. But as soon as he did, the same Twitter mob chimed in once again, complaining that he was supporting a bigot and a homophobe and turning a blind eye to the feelings of gays. It only took a few well-placed tweets from different accounts to make him run for cover and pull the plug. It was an unlikely scenario anyway. No venue had been confirmed, no terms really agreed upon, but content was generated all around, and the social media monster had a nice snack that day. With 25 years of radical protest under her belt, the punk activist was now the pariah of the PC community. She was, in her words, box office poison. "It's okay," she tweeted. "If you want somebody to hate, hate me." She explained, "It's like when the Sex Pistols went to Texas to play. Their intention was not to make the Billboard Top 100. They wanted to spit on cowboys. And they succeeded. And the cowboys spat back in return. It was, as I said, a demonstration." As weeks wore on, bits of truth floated to the top, but were washed under as quickly as they surfaced. And then another offer came. It was from Dan Noyes of ABC's KAGO TV, curious about the whole situation with Vogt. It seemed to him like a breach of journalistic ethics. Would truth finally will out? Anticipation was in the air. On June 26, 2013, Michelle tweeted to Dan, "Bring on the noise, bring on the funk. KAGO always gets their punk." A modern revolutionary heads for the TV station, Abby Hoffman. Dan Noyes replied, "I'm trying to figure out how to frame that tweet for posterity. Hope you have a great weekend, Michelle." And the ever-present Chris Willman chimed in, "Is your Michelle Shocked interview still running today?" Setting cynicism aside, Michelle agreed to the interview, and Noyes showed up hoping to set the record straight. I mean, STR8. I mean, there was a predictable detour about halfway through an otherwise solid conversation. When the interview aired, Noyes started with the usual questions about what Michelle meant at Yoshi's, and she explained, "All I was trying to do in San Francisco was try to get two sides that aren't talking to each other and are demonizing each other to realize they have a lot more in common than they have to fear. They're demonizing each other, and it needs to stop." He then moved into the topic of Vogt's offer. Vogt, he explained, owns three of the city's major newspapers and is about to buy a large share of a fourth. That fourth newspaper is San Francisco's main LGBT paper, the Bay Area Reporter. His offer, according to Yumi Wilson, associate professor at San Francisco State University and an expert in journalistic ethics, could be a case study in what not to do as a publisher. She explained that newspapers can't build trust based on objectivity if they're directing editorial coverage based on a dollar amount. Michelle described it simply. "It's called extortion. You pull the plug, you censor someone, you take away their voice, and then you tell them, 'You want to speak? Give me a little bite, and I'll make sure you get a voice.' That's extortion." Vogt's immediate backpedaling caught Noyes' eye, but it was his claim that the ad was Michelle's idea in the first place that made him really wonder. He asked what she thought of him saying that. She smiled and said, "I think he threw me under the bus." The email trail proved that the invitation for the ad came from the Examiner first. But Vogt insisted otherwise until Michelle started posting bits of their negotiation on Twitter. The conversation could have ended there, but Noyes decided to go for the money shot and ask Michelle the same question she had answered 1,000 times before. He asked about her sex life. She tried to explain that her sexuality was not the issue at hand, but then, under continued questioning, unleashed a well-worn annoyance. She stood up, ripped off the microphone, paced for a few seconds like a caged animal, and finally sat down to explain through clenched teeth, "Do you think someone as outspoken as me would have been in the closet all these years?" Noyes had to concede the point. Michelle insisted on ending the interview. They ended on a cordial note, with Michelle rolling her eyes at yet another derailed conversation. The interview aired on June 28, 2013, under the well-behaved and polite title, "Local Newspaper Publisher Makes Deal with Singer." Such a quiet little headline. Perhaps a moment of silence. Perhaps not. Michelle doesn't stay quiet for long. Instead, she met up with a big-hearted bear, Chamito Conchito, at her outreach ministry in MacArthur Park, and moving between two worlds, headed on up to SF Pride anyway. Michelle was decked out in her star-spangled burqa, strutting and dancing to Michael Jackson's "They Don't Care About Us" in a flash mob to support another censored voice, Chelsea Manning.